everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Beats Research Radio. We are a podcast and YouTube channel that aims to disseminate science and research to the community. My name is Ryan, and I am an undergraduate student studying biomedical science at the University of Ottawa, and I will be your host in today's episode. This short episode is a part of a series exploring the impact of exercise and fitness on our health. In today's episode, we are honored to be joined by Dr. Emmanuel Stamatakis. Dr. Stamatakis is a professor of physical activity, lifestyle, and population health at the University of Sydney. Dr. Stamatakis leads a research program that uses cohort studies to examine the impact of lifestyles involving physical activity, sedentary behavior, and sleep on the risk of developing non-communicable diseases. Dr. Stamatakis co-chaired the World Health Organization's Physical Activity and Sedentary Behavior Guidelines Development Group. As of December 2023, he has published 400 peer-reviewed papers and was named in Clarivate's highly cited researcher list for 4 years, distinction awarded to around 1 in 1,000 researchers worldwide. We are honored to have him join us today.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Of course, it's a pleasure to have you here, as always. My first question for you, Doctor, will be based on your research focus on cohort studies. What exactly does a cohort study mean, and what was your motivation in pursuing research based on that?
Yeah, there are quite a few there's quite a bit different terminology to describe cohort studies. Some members of the audience may have heard the term observational studies or prospective observational studies. They are one and the same thing. So as the name implies, observational, that is the kind of study which observes people following their regular lifestyles, doing the regular things they would do anyway. So this is a very distinct different type of research compared to experimental research, randomized controlled trials, where people are allocated on a specific intervention, a specific behavior. So a typical cohort study will recruit a sample of people. These are usually very large studies in the order of thousands or tens of thousands or a hundred of thousands. We have been working, for example, with the UK Biobank, which over 2006 and 2010, recruited 500,000 adults in the UK. There are Australian cohorts, a quarter of a million adults, the 45 and up cohort study, for example. So they recruit people at one point in time, let's call that time point A, and they measure them at baseline, and some of those studies go back and remeasure them after certain periods, 5 years, 10 years, 3 years. It varies by cohort study. They measure them over and over again, trying to record snapshots of how people behave, what is their health status, what changes have occurred during the time to their health status and their behavior in relation to the risk to develop chronic diseases. And we typically get the information about chronic diseases and death as well, and the cause of death, through medical records, administrative health records. So there is an element of linkage also to the cohort studies. And this is what it makes cohort studies extremely powerful. If you do a randomized controlled trial, of course, randomized controlled trials have other advantages because you're in more control of the lifestyle exposure of your interest, physical activity, for example. But there is no way that you can carry out a randomized controlled trial that will last 10 or 15 years because it would be prohibitively expensive. There is no funder out there. Just like an example is that when we think about studies, randomized controlled trials with mortality endpoints, there is one trial, the Generation 100 study. On the other hand, there are thousands of studies that have been performed using observational cohort study designs. So it's a critical, when it comes to health-related research, particularly with lifestyle-related exposures like physical activity, exercise, smoking, alcohol, cohort studies is an extremely important design, and the source of the information of much what we know about these behaviors and how they influence human health.
That's great. Thank you for your insight on that. I noticed that something that's really exciting about the work that you've done is you have led a team in the World Health Organization to develop physical activity recommendations for adults. I'm wondering what goes into making these guidelines, and is there a role in using the cohort studies?
Cohort studies play a critical role in guidelines development, and as a rough back of the envelope calculation, it may not be 100% precise, but the total, considering all the evidence that was used to develop the World Health Organization's, for example, 2020 physical activity and sedentary behavior guidelines, considering the totality of the evidence that was reviewed and synthesized, I would estimate that approximately 90-95%, perhaps more than that, of the evidence was cohort studies based evidence with mortality and incident disease outcomes mostly. So this is a process. It's an extremely important, the guidelines development as a process is extremely important for public health and for science as well, because it is a state of the art, very high standard, very rigorous synthesis of the evidence, which means that out of the tens of thousands of studies out there, guidelines development groups and committees select, screen, and choose what evidence is of the highest quality so that it can be synthesized and distilled into some recommendations which are clear for people and policymakers to understand, for the media to understand. And it's a process that involves usually tens, if not hundreds of people. The World Health Organization 2020 effort, for example, involved approximately 40 scientists from six continents, including WHO officials. And of course, that was the core team only. There were a lot of helpers. For example, my team in Sydney did a lot of screening of reviews and a lot of kind of ancillary secondary tasks. And they take usually anything between 1.5 to 3 years. WHO, the whole effort from start to end took just over a year and a half. So they are important because they reflect the current state of the evidence. First of all, they summarize the current state of the evidence. And they summarize not only what we know about physical activity, exercise, and sedentary behavior, they also, one of the very important outcomes of guideline efforts is that they very explicitly list and reflect what is it that we do not know. Science is never perfect, and we are always improving our methods. We are improving our understanding of how to interpret evidence and how we need to improve our methods, what kind of studies we need to do to get a more in-depth, more detailed, and more accurate understanding of those types and aspects of physical activity that have the highest potential to improve the health of a population. So a number of functions. In addition, I could just like highlight another couple of functions the guidelines play, which is a communication tool between scientists, the developers, the guideline developers, other scientists, the rest of the research community, between scientists and practitioners like clinicians, physiotherapists, doctors, a communication tool between the media and the public. So the main guidelines, the main recommendations, essentially they become a physical activity promotion tool. And these are the guidelines that very often the journalists will put in their articles as to the desired amounts, what targets people should be striving for, what is the daily physical activity they should strive for, and many, many similar functions. Last but not the least, very important function of guidelines is that they become somehow the yardstick how policy large-scale national policy, how policymakers can know whether they are meeting targets around physical activity. So
it's great to hear how much scientific reasoning and effort's been put into creating these guidelines. And it's really interesting to know that these guidelines aren't only for individuals themselves, but it's also for scientists, for clinicians to use in their practice, in their daily practice, as well as the policymakers who are going to be setting the standards for the future as well. My next question actually involves your mentioning of the wearable devices. I understand that your role is a co-leader of the Prospective Physical Activity Sitting and Sleeping Consortium. It's known as ProPass. Could you share a bit more about the ProPass initiative and if it relates or helps in developing these activity recommendations that you've mentioned so far?
ProPass, we initiated ProPass in Sydney back in 2017. Originally, I started it as a network of scientists who worked on cohort studies. Then very rapidly became a network of cohort studies, and now we're putting together a data resource. Now, important, and the timing here is very fortunate and serendipitous in many ways, because I started this in 2017, well before I had any idea that I would be invited by WHO to co-chair the guidelines development group some 2 years later. Because ProPass, it's very serendipitous in a way, because ProPass was set up in mind with the transition of the evidence base from questionnaires to wearable devices, evidence that comes from wearable devices. Why this is very important? So we have approximately 40 years of research using cohort studies which use questionnaires to evaluate, to measure physical activity, sensory behavior, sleep, which becomes also part of the same paradigm. Eventually, I believe that the sleep guidelines will be incorporated into physical activity guidelines. Of course, very good. This kind of evidence has served public health and science very well. This is not a criticism about the evidence or the people who gathered such evidence. We have done a lot of work with questionnaire-based evidence. This evidence, we are acknowledging now that it's very limited. And there are many reasons why. So questionnaires, in a nutshell, what they're okay at, not extremely good, but okay at, they're okay at capturing leisure time, recreational exercise. So these are the things that we are doing in our free time for health, fitness, appearance, fun, going to gyms, doing classes, yoga, Pilates, running, swimming, recreational cycling, all these things that we're doing in our free time for fun, health, and recreation. This is a very small subset. If you consider the whole population in any high-income country, the amount of time, average amount of time that adults spend on doing these recreational activities is not more than 3 to 5%, 3 to 5% of total time. So it's a very small component of the overall physical activity. So questionnaires are not good at all in capturing what we do, the all incidental things we do in our day-to-day routines, because these are things that don't involve planning, you know, just going to the shops, walking back and from work, all these things. We don't plan them. They happen as part of our day-to-day living, domestic activities around the household, housework, cleaning, hoovering, and all these things. These activities do not involve planning, and therefore it's not very easy or impossible in some cases to retrieve it and recall it and report it accurately in a questionnaire. Okay, so the limitation here is that the main limitation in a nutshell, that questionnaires only capture certain aspects of human physical activity. What happens to the remaining 95% of incidental movement? If we don't capture it, we cannot understand. If we cannot measure it, we cannot understand what its health potential. We cannot develop interventions. We cannot advise, support people advise them more, support them more tangibly to increase that part of their physical activity. And that's exactly where wearables are coming into play, and they are changing. They are changing the way we think and the way what we understand about physical activity and its potential. So wearables essentially capture everything we do because they're worn continuously for 24 hours per day. So if you happen, for example, to go to a gym, and there is a huge accuracy advantage as well that they have. If you go to the gym, let's say on a Saturday for 1 hour, the chances are that you will spend exercise for approximately 20, 25 minutes maximum. Could be high intensity exercise, could be moderate intensity exercise. It doesn't really matter. It will be around 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and then the rest of the time will be checking your phone, drinking water, getting changed, all sorts of other things. So in a questionnaire-based study, your response would be, I went to the gym for 1 hour and I did moderate to vigorous intensity exercise. That's what would be recorded. If you were wearing a tracker at the same time, the tracker would pick up most activities you were doing, and the chances are that the tracker will tell you that you did about 5 to 10 minutes of vigorous and another 10 to 15 minutes of moderate intensity. So in total, you did about 20, 25 minutes of physical activity in total. So that's a big discrepancy, 60 minutes vigorous versus 15, 20, 25 minutes, whatever the tracker picks up. So there is an accuracy advantage as well. Considering our research program and the direction our research program has taken in the last few years, and is very likely to expand in this area, we're very interested in the power of incidental physical activity. And we have published, I should perhaps mention a couple of examples from our program. We have published on the concept of VILPA recently. VILPA is an acronym that stands for Vigorous Intermittent Lifestyle Physical Activity. And in a nutshell, it's all these things that we do as part of our day-to-day routines that get us out of breath, they raise the heart rate, and sometimes these bouts of incidental physical activity, of vigorous incidental physical activity, could last 30 seconds, 1 minute, a minute and a half, 2 minutes. We're talking about very brief bursts of incidental activity of vigorous intensity. The evidence we have generated so far, through cohort studies in particular, it's extremely encouraging. Of course, it's early days, so we want our studies to be reproduced by other teams and the results to be replicated. But the first signs are extremely promising because we can see that with very little activity, VILPA activity of this kind, activity that does not demand people to make any time for it. So being time poor, it's not a reason not to do this, because it's about modulating day-to-day tasks to reach high intensity, to get a bit out of breath for 30 seconds or 1 minute. We have seen, for example, that for the equivalent of 3 VILPA bouts lasting 1 minute each was associated with approximately 50% reduction in cardiovascular mortality risk. So 3 minutes by 7 days, an average of 20, 25 minutes of physical activity per week, physical activity that does not require time commitment, that does not require special preparations, that does not require gym memberships or health club memberships. So the list of potential feasibility advantages is very, 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 very long, and very small amounts of this kind of VILPA activity associated with very large potential health effects. We have expanded this line of inquiry into moderate to vigorous physical activity. The equivalent concept here is MV-ILPA, moderate to vigorous intermittent lifestyle physical activity, which is bouts of moderate to vigorous activity lasting up to 3 minutes. In some studies, we have seen that the longer the bout of moderate to vigorous activity, the better, the lower, the largest the reduction in risk for cardiovascular disease, for example. But for the purposes of communicating this research to media and the general public, I want to always emphasize that here we are talking about very short bursts of high intensity, up to 1 minute, and fairly short bouts of moderate to vigorous intensity, up to 3 minutes. This kind of research offers a lot of support for interventions targeting incidental physical activity. And I think there is huge potential there because of the size of the population, the part of the population that 80% who are reluctant, are not willing, are not keen, or perhaps there are some physical disabilities as well that prevent them from doing structured exercise. So I think this is an area that public health and research needs to focus in the next few years. And I believe and I hope that the incidental physical activity will become one day, perhaps in the next edition of WHO's guidelines, incidental physical activity, there will be specific targets around incidental physical activity, non-exercise physical activity, because the rules of engagement are very, very different. The rules of participation, the context of participation in leisure time exercise is very different to the context of participation in incidental physical activity.
Thank you for sharing that with us. It's great to hear that it's not just about the active exercise that is reported, but there's also, you do exercise from day to day, like you said, with incidental exercise. And I'm sure that listeners will definitely take home the message here and be mindful of the impact of staying physically healthy after this episode. So thank you for joining us today, Dr. Stamatakis. It was great to hear about your research.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ryan. Have a good day.
Thank you. And thank you to all of the Beats Research Radio listeners for tuning in as well. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram channels at Beats Research. On behalf of our entire radio team and our director, Dr. Emilio Alarcón, we hope to see you all in the next episode.